feeling joyful about whatever you were doing. And I looked at the plans for today and I said, well, we get to do retreat and be on vacation with Medicine Buddha all day. And I said, wow, it doesn't get much better than that. Okay. So that's what we're going to be doing today. And Medicine Buddha is, like all the Buddhas, is our best friend, our best companion, the best one to rely on, the one who can really help us. We usually take refuge in ordinary sentient beings who are overpowered by afflictions and karma, who take rebirth under the influence of ignorance. And we take refuge in these people and think they will protect us and give us good advice. And no wonder we wind up in a mess. Whereas here, we're turning to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for refuge. And for sure, Medicine Buddha is going to give us good advice. Yeah. He won't encourage us to break precepts. He won't, manipulate us to get something for himself. And so we can trust the advice of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There is a passage from one of the Pali scriptures. I really need to copy it out because I can't remember it, word by word. But in it, the Buddha is saying, during my life in samsara, I took refuge in ordinary beings who have afflictions. And yet, what did I expect from doing that? When you take refuge in people who have anger, who are confused and don't understand cause and effect, people who are greedy or whatever, and yet we expect that, we're going to get good advice and those people are going to take care of us. And so this is problematic. Have you ever followed bad advice given by well-meaning people? Yeah. Again, I don't know how many of you are following events in the U.S., but this is an incredible example of it just happened with one of Trump's lawyers who was his fixer and was the one who solved all his problems and did so much for him. And it misled that man. And now he was arrested, he was prosecuted, he's going to be serving prison time. And now he's really regretting that he lost his moral compass under the influence of Trump because he just kind of idolized the man. So this is such a good example of what we do too. When we lose our discriminating awareness and take refuge in people who don't have equal-hearted compassion for everybody, when we take refuge in people who don't understand the ultimate nature, then they may seemingly mean well, but it spells trouble. Okay, so today, going on vacation with the Medicine Buddha, we're not going to have that problem. Okay, we can relax, we can trust the advice we get. Trusting the advice that we get from the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha does not mean that we don't question it, that we just have blind belief. The Buddha himself really emphasized the importance that we investigate his teachings, we think about them, we test them out. We don't just have blind belief because the Buddha said it. Okay? So this is very important because we need to think about the teachings so that we understand how to practice them and so that we understand them correctly. And And this is why you can see in the Nalanda tradition, which began at Nalanda University in ancient India, the practice of debating the teachings. You debate, you really try and understand, you question. So the Buddha spoke about two kinds of disciples, sharp faculty disciples and dull faculty disciples. Okay? Sharp faculty disciples are people who question, who use reasoning to understand the teachings. And they're people who especially investigate the nature of reality in order to develop confidence that attaining liberation and attaining full awakening is actually possible. When they have that confidence derived from their own reasoning and contemplation that attaining these spiritual results is possible, then they generate bodhicitta, and then they really engage fully in the practice. Okay? The dull faculty disciples are ones who have great faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but their faith isn't based on reasoning. And so they hear a teaching and they say, I believe it. Why? Because Buddha said so, or because my teacher said so. But they haven't really thought about the meaning of the teaching. Yeah? So it's just, okay, somebody will respect it, said so, so I accept it without questioning. And the Buddha called these dull faculty disciples because their faith is not stable. If somebody else came along and taught them something different, then they would just say, oh, yeah, I'll follow that guy. Yeah? Yeah, that philosophy makes sense. You know? There's a pink pumpkin in the sky, and if we worship it, it will, you know, give us worldly success. Oh, yes, I'll do that. You know? So it we're not thinking, and therefore our faith isn't stable and can be shaken. And it becomes possible to follow wrong paths. So that's what the Buddha really emphasized for us to think about the teachings, question them, yeah, really understand them, and then our practice becomes quite stable. Yeah. Then, even if somebody comes along and says, you're a Buddhist, that's hogwash, it's all made up stories, what are you doing? You know, then you aren't moved by what that person says. You know, the peer pressure from somebody else doesn't influence you because you know why you believe what you believe. And you know why the path is what it is. Okay? Is this making some sense to you? So nobody else can check the teachings out for us. Yeah. This is something we have to do with ourselves. So we're going to be doing the medicine Buddha practice. And on one hand, it might seem like, oh, well, this is a perfect example of doing things on faith. Yeah. We visualize medicine Buddha. We make offerings, then we request blessings from Medicine Buddha, as if now Medicine Buddha is going to do things for us. Okay? Medicine Buddha, please make me realize bodhicitta. Please give me good health. Please help me to understand emptiness. Please help me to find Buddha boy and get married. So do you think that Medicine Buddha can do all of that for you? That's what ordinary people pray to a creator for. You know? And see, the creator is like the manager of the universe who can do all these things. And if we pray to the Buddha, having that same kind of mind, we're somehow missing the point. Okay? So it's important when we're meditating on our medicine Buddha today to, on one hand, you can see him as a person, you know, who's an ordinary being who practiced the path and attained a full awakening and became medicine Buddha. But in another way, you can see medicine Buddha as the expression of enlightened qualities. And this view of medicine Buddha doesn't emphasize him so much as a person, yeah, but as a representation of the Buddha's qualities in a physical form. So why would there be such a representation? Well, the Buddha's Dharmakaya mind, the Buddha's omniscient mind, can we understand that mind directly? Hello? Yeah? Can you, you know, speak to the Buddha's omniscient mind directly? No, it's way beyond anything that we can conceive of. So the Buddha, out of compassion, appears in physical forms that represent the qualities, because in that way we can communicate better with the Buddha, we can or connect better with the Buddha. Okay? So that means that all of medicine Buddha's physical features are illustrating the mental qualities that he has. Okay? So if we look at medicine Buddha, yes. Yeah. And I think you all have a picture of medicine Buddha, which was kindly offered. So when you look, the first thing that strikes you is his deep blue color. So the deep blue color, it's like the sky, it's like the ocean. It's something very vast. Yeah. So it reminds us that the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's knowledge, is very deep, very vast. And the blue color is a cooling color. Yeah. So it reminds us to chill out. I've been seeing posters around Singapore. Chill out. Go to the concert tonight. You think some rock concert is going to make you chill out? So when we think of a deep blue color, that helps settle our mind, doesn't it? It's a cooling color. It cools the passions, you know, of intense attachment or the flames of anger. Yeah. Buddha has a crown protrusion called the Nisnisha. Okay. So that's not because he bumped his head in that concussion. But they speak of 32 signs of awakened beings. And this is an ancient Indian tradition. Yeah, this isn't a specifically Buddhist. But in ancient India, they said awakened beings, there's 32 physical qualities that are indicative of having attained awakening. And the Usnisha on the top of the head is one of them. Okay? And it represents the vast amount of virtuous actions to benefit sentient beings that the Buddha has done while on the Bodhisattva path. Yeah. And so, if you think medicine Buddha, you know, practiced the Bodhisattva path for three countless great eons, that's a long time. We want to get enlightened by next week. Let's do it, get it over with, and then we can go on and have a career. But it's not like that. Yesterday we were talking about joyous effort. So to have that joyous effort that takes delight in benefiting others, that takes delight in practicing for three countless great eons. That isn't saying, listen, can we shorten it? Three countless great eons is a lot. Can we make it 2.5? Yeah, because you know how we like to bargain for things. So we want to bargain with the Buddha. We want to bargain with the Dharma. As if they could shorten the path. No, it depends on our exerting energy. It could take 2.5, it could take 3.5. It could take even more eons, but depending on the joyous effort and the strength of our motivation with which we practice. The Buddha is wearing monks' robes, the monastic robes. So that symbolizes ethical conduct. And ethical conduct is the foundation of so much of the Buddhist path. Whether you practice the fundamental vehicle with the Four Noble Truths, or you practice the perfection vehicle, the Mahayana, or you practice Vajrayana, all of those depend on ethical conduct. And that's very important to understand, because sometimes you hear, in Vajrayana there's no good, there's no bad. Now, you hear people say that. Well, when you're fully awakened, there's no good and no bad, because you always do what is perfect. You always do what is right to do. You don't break precepts. You don't go against the law of karma and its effects. You've realized emptiness. So you see there's no inherently existing good or inherently existing bad. So that applies to very high bodhisattvas and Buddhas. But many people at our level, although I don't know, maybe some of you are bodhisattvas and Buddhas, I'm not. At my level, if I say, oh, there's no good, there's no bad, it's all in your mind. Do whatever you want, just have compassion. Then, with great compassion, because you're so messed up, I'm going to punch you in the nose so that you learn a lesson. Yeah? What do you think about that? Okay. So this is why we hear of scandals in the Buddhist community. Oh, it's no good, there's no bad. And your teacher wants to have sex with you, and your teacher is the highest object of offering. You create so much merit, so you give your body and have sex with your teacher. Huh? Huh? Excuse me? Okay. So, we get these wrong kind of ideas, and then we're just taken away by, here's a Rinpoche, here's a Lama, here's a monk, whoever it happens to be. And it's like, they chose me. Did they choose you? I'm prettier than you. I'm smarter than you. They chose me. Okay? So I'm saying this because I don't know in Singapore if other teachers talk about this or not? Do they talk about this? No, I didn't think so. Yeah? One of my friends in Seattle, she's a Chinese nun in the Chinese Mahayana tradition, and one teacher came to her temple, and one of the devotees really liked that teacher. And the teacher said, oh, my family needs, you know, money for this and that. And this woman just kept giving him money and more money and more money until she was in financial problems and couldn't pay her bills. Okay? So, I'm not saying don't be generous. I'm saying be wise. Yeah. Don't get swept off your feet by charisma. The Buddha gave very clear a very clear description of the qualities to look for in good teachers. Yeah. Such as ethical conduct, meditative experience, knowledge and wisdom of emptiness, compassion, and so on. Charisma was not one of those qualities. And you know what charisma is? Well, somebody is excited and gets you all jazzed up. Okay. So last year, it was just 2 months ago, I went to a monastic conference in the U.S. We have conferences for the last 24 years. We've had conferences where the Western and Asian teachers in the U.S. get together from all the different traditions. Yeah? And so we meet together for 5 days. And it's a wonderful experience. It's not a conference. We don't write papers. We don't produce reports. We become friends. And so we spend 5 days together talking about things of mutual concern, because being a monastic in the West is a very unusual experience. It's quite different than being a monastic in Singapore or Taiwan or Korea or, you know, in a Buddhist country. So 2 months ago, one of the issues that came up was sexual abuse. Because in America, this has been a big issue for a number of years. And now women are speaking up about it and, you know, revealing it instead of being filled with shame and keeping it hidden. And so we were discussing this, and especially sexual abuse as it occurs in Buddhist organizations. And one of the, because you may know that the Catholic Church is in a big problem because of sexual abuse. Yeah, and it's a huge problem. And now many Protestant, you know, evangelical ministers, similar, you know, problems with sexual abuse. So we were discussing this, and one of the points that came out was that we need better education, and we needed to educate people about what is proper conduct and what is not proper conduct. Yeah, so that people are not led astray by charisma. And so I know this is a dicey subject because nobody talks about it in Singapore. Nobody even talks about sex in Singapore, let alone in none. But, you know, we decided as a group of monks and nuns that this was, that we needed more education about this. so that people were very clear when you go to a Buddhist teaching, it's to learn the Dharma. It's not to become somebody important. It's not to be swept away by the teacher's attention on you individually. It's to learn how to abandon your mental afflictions and develop your good qualities. Okay. So stay focused on that. And if somebody approaches you, oh, you are a special person. Or somebody, especially for women, says, oh, come to my room, in the evening and I'll answer your Dharma questions. Or something like that. Don't get involved in it. It only leads you to a lot of pain, and it leads to degeneration of the Dharma. So be very clear on your own ethical code and what you want to do and what you don't want to do. And if somebody, whether it is a teacher, a Dharma teacher or not, asks you to go against that ethical code, then you very freely say no. And you leave. There's nothing wrong with that. One woman once came to me and she was saying, oh, I was studying with this one teacher in Nepal and he asked me to come to his room in the evening and he gave such good teachings. And, I thought, wow, I'll get a personal teaching. But I didn't feel comfortable going alone to his room in the evening. So I said no. But now I'm really full of doubts. Maybe I made the wrong decision. Maybe I missed having a special personalized teacher and teaching. And she said, did I make a mistake? And I said, no, you did the right thing. Yeah, you have confidence. If your gut tells you something fishy is going on, listen to that, okay? So, back to my initial point. I go off on tangents a lot. Okay, but the medicine Buddha's wearing monastic robes. So, if you are a monastic, you are celibate, period. No exceptions, okay? So, if somebody is wearing monastic robes, they should be celibate. If they're not, and you know they're not, then you tell somebody, because they shouldn't be wearing robes. It's important that people keep their precepts. Similarly, I know that people dress up as monastics and they go in the MRT and if those people are not monastics but they're wearing monastic robes, they're actually creating great negative karma. Because they're deceiving people in that way. When they talk about the degeneration of the Dharma, it's not so much from outside forces as it is from our not keeping good ethical conduct. And so, like I was saying before I went off on that tangent, whether you're practicing the fundamental vehicle with the four truths, the perfection vehicle, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, everything depends on ethical conduct. And there's different levels of ethical conduct. There's the five precepts and the five lay precepts and the monastic precepts. Those are all on the level of what we call pratimoksha, or individual liberation. Then there's the Bodhisattva precepts. Then there's the Tantra precepts. Yeah? So if you want to get realizations, we have to keep the precepts. And I see many people, coming and saying, oh, Tantra is so wonderful. I want tantric initiation. They have no idea what the tantric precepts are, what the commitments are. But they happily take them. Actually, they're quite difficult to keep. But, oh, I'll take them because I want the highest teaching. But then they say, but this teacher's teaching about the five precepts? That's such a basic teaching. I learned, nah, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. I learned that at 6 years old from my parents. Why do I have to go to a Dharma class to learn that? That's old stuff. I am a very high exalted practitioner. I take tantric initiations. Okay. And then they think that the more they hear bells ring and drums play, and the more everything's in Tibetan, so the less they understand, then the bigger the blessing must be. Okay? That shows our lack of intelligence. Yeah? You think you're going to get some big blessing when you don't understand anything? Yeah? The whole meaning of blessing, the term jinla in Tibetan, means to transform the mind. To transform the mind into a more exalted state. So receiving a blessing means that we have to transform our minds. Yeah. It's not that you get some holy water and you get a long life pill and somebody hits you on the head and that does it. Boing. Now I'm really enlightened. You just got a concussion. Okay? So it's not the substances. They use the substances as a way to get us to think clearly and to focus our mind and to imagine the kind of realizations the Buddha has, and to turn our mind towards those realizations. Okay. There was one lama who was very good. He
was talking about blessing cards.
Do you have blessing cards? Oh, you don't have blessing cards. But if you wear this cord, you are blessed. Yeah? So this lama was talking about, he said, they're often called protection cords, So we think protection means, from spirits and enemies and external beings. It actually means protection from our own ignorance and afflictions, okay? By meditating on emptiness and dependent arising. That's what it's supposed to protect us from, because it reminds us to meditate on emptiness and dependent arising. But anyway, this lama was saying, oh, the protection cords. Yeah, you think it's going to protect you from harm, but you have to protect it. Otherwise, it gets dirty, it gets broken, it falls apart. How is it going to protect you when you have to protect it? So I thought, oh, that llama, it's good. he's telling it as it is. Because somehow we always want to turn towards something external. Yeah, don't we? It's so hard dealing with our own mental afflictions. We want some easy path. where something external is going to do it for us. And, you know, I think the most powerful teaching the Buddha gave was that our experience comes from our own mind. So if we want our experience to change, we have to change our mind. It's not about changing everything around us and external things giving us lots of blessings. Like I said, those things can inspire our mind, but it's the inspiration in our mind that makes us turn our mind towards the Dharma that is the actual blessing or protection. Okay. I remember when I lived in Nepal, you know, especially, you know, the Tibetans, everybody collected blessing cords. Yeah. So people would have like maybe 20 blessing cords. Yeah. And one of the lamas used to joke, that just gives more space for the lice to live. Because most of these villagers had lice, and the lice, you know, just, they lived in the blessing cords. Okay? So, you're looking at Medicine Buddha, you know, wearing monastic robes. He's indicating ethical conduct, and how important ethical conduct is for us. Because if we keep good ethical conduct, people will trust us. If we don't keep good ethical conduct, people will not trust us. I remember one time, many years ago, some of you from SPBS, okay, wake up, SPBS people, wake up, you in the back, hey. So I remember one time we had a discussion about what are qualities you look for in good friends. Yeah? And so people were talking about, do you remember that discussion? We were talking about what qualities make us attracted to people. What qualities make us want to become friends with people. And so, of course, somebody with, you know, a sense of humor, somebody who's fun to be with, but somebody we can trust, somebody who we can tell personal things to, who's not going to go blabbering them all over the place, somebody who's going to tell us the truth, somebody who's not going to steal our stuff, or cheat us, or punch us in the nose, okay? Somebody who's not going to gossip about us behind our back and tell other people all sorts of stories about how awful we are. Okay? Are those qualities that you look for in friends? Yeah. So we were discussing this in SPBS, and then the conclusion of the discussion was, wow, the things that we look for in friends were the 10 virtuous actions that the Buddha set forth, the opposite of the 10 non-virtues. And then it was like, oh, that's why the Buddha talked about, you know, the 10 non-virtues to abandon and the opposites, the 10 virtues to practice. Because if we do that, we become the kind of trustworthy people that other people will want to have as friends. And we also avoid negativity and create merit, which will help us on the path to awakening. Okay? So ethical conduct is not some kind of, you know, thing for six-year-olds. It's actually, the more you go into the precepts and really think about them, the more there is in them, yeah, and the more there is to think about and reflect about in terms of our own actions and our own thoughts. Yeah. They're quite profound.
for example, like the precept, the fifth precept, not to take intoxicants. Literally, it's not to take alcohol. So does that mean that you can then take recreational drugs? No. Okay. Does that mean because it only says to abandon alcohol that you can abuse prescription drugs? No. Okay. In my country now, there's a huge problem with people abusing prescription drugs. Yeah? And people taking oxycodone and all sorts of opioids, getting addicted to these painkillers, then, you know, going on the streets to buy some of them, and the you know, heroin and so forth being cut with fentanyl, which is an even more powerful opioid, and then people overdosing in public. Yeah. And finding people just collapsed on the street. I saw a video online, oh, this really tore me apart, of a mother who had taken opioids, blacked out in the middle of the grocery store, was lying on the floor in the grocery store with her two-year-old child pulling on her arms and saying, "Mama, Mama," and the mother is completely unresponsive. And the child is freaking out. She knows something's wrong with her mom. You know? So this kind of thing of abuse of prescription drugs, you know, I don't think it's a big problem in Singapore. Yeah? I hope it never becomes a problem in Singapore. But it's a big problem in my country. And a very high death rate of people ODing. In fact, we had one young man, well, he wasn't that young, he was in his mid-30s, and he, you know, had had a drug problem. His father was a first responder, somebody who went in ambulances when there was emergencies. His father had become addicted to drugs because he had access to them through his work. His father OD'd, yeah, and died from drug overdose. The son got into drugs. He was getting off drugs. He came and spent a few months at the Abbey. He was doing really well, and he wrote his parents that it was the happiest he had ever been. And then at one point he said, "Okay, you know, I'm clean now. I'll go back to my hometown." We didn't agree, but he's an adult. He went back. And then a few months later, we received an email from his mom and from his grandma that he had overdosed and died. Yeah. And, I mean, for me, again, this was so painful. Somebody you know dying in a way that they don't need to die. Yeah. So, the intoxicant precept is a very important one. Now, we might say, well, I'm not going to take those kind of drugs. I'm not going to overdose. But, of course, that's what all the people who take the drugs and overdose think. But what about alcohol? Yeah. Alcohol's a big problem. I talked to one mother. She was telling me that her husband used to drink a lot. And he collected all the bottles of, you know, the fancy kind of expensive liquor that he would drink, and different kind of beer and all that kind of stuff. And he had a whole shelf in his house with all the bottles and beer cans and things. And he thought it was really, the father thought it was really kind of cool. Well, the son started drinking too. And one night, the son was drunk, got in a car accident, killed 4 people, and himself wound up in a coma. Okay, so think of the karma, you know, of killing 4 people because you were intoxicated, you know, what that does to other people's lives and their families. And then plus, he was in a coma because of his injuries. He was kept being in a coma, he didn't come out. And eventually the parents were faced with the decision of, because he was intubated, he was on a breathing machine, the parents were faced with the decision of whether to pull the plug and take him off the breathing machine. And they decided to do it. And it was gut-wrenching for the parents. Can you imagine seeing your child in a coma and you having to make the decision to take them off the breathing machine, knowing that they were going to die? It was horrible for the parents. The father went home after that. All of his collection of bottles went, he was so distraught. Because he realized that by drinking himself, he set the example for his son to drink. Yeah, and that's what happened. Okay. So, the intoxicant precept, I'm telling you these kinds of stories, they're rather shocking and they're true, and I know the people. But there's all sorts of subtle ways that we intoxicate ourselves. Okay? For example, gambling. Did you ever think of gambling as a form of intoxication? Yeah? It's, people get intoxicated. You know, intoxicated in the sense that they lose their ability to think clearly. That's what intoxication means. You can't think clearly. You can't make good decisions. People who are gambling addicts cannot make good decisions. I know one person, you know, quite well. Her mother is a gambling addict. Her mother wound up taking her wedding ring to the pawn shop to get more money so she could go gambling. I know a few people in Singapore, who have relatives with gambling problems and how it destroys the family, not only financially, but in terms of family harmony. And then what does it do to your mind? People who gamble, say, they get a big rush, I'm gonna win the jackpot. I'm gonna win the lot of money. And if most people won a lot of money, then there wouldn't be casinos, because the casinos would have gone broke. So the fact that there are casinos and that the casinos make a lot of money indicates that it's very likely you're going to lose your money by gambling. So you're paying money to have this rush of excitement, thinking falsely that you're going to win. Okay? Problematic, isn't it? So gambling is a form of intoxication. Yeah. Now I'm going to say one that's really going to shock you.
Shopping.
You hit it. You got it. Shopping. I once went on pilgrimage with a group of Singaporeans. I
I, you guys got it already. I didn't even need to say anything more. So I learned that, you know, for Singapore, there's not the usual six bodhisattva perfections. There's a seventh one, the perfection of shopping, that Singaporeans definitely have perfected. Because we were at all these holy sites, and I wanted to go look at the cave carvings. I wanted to make prostrations to the bodhisattvas, you know. I wanted to go inside the temples, and they all wanted to go shopping outside the temples. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so shopping is kind of an addiction, isn't it? What do you do when you feel bored? You know, you go buy something. And nowadays, you don't even need to leave your house. You just go online and you buy all sorts of stuff you don't need, that whereby we use more of the Earth's resources than we're entitled to. We have the thing, we get it, we feel 5 minutes of pleasure, and after that we're bored. And it clutters up our house, but we can't give it away. Okay? We don't want to give it away, even though somebody else could use it, even though there's lots of people who are in need, who are poor, even though we're not using it, we can't give it away. Okay? So this is, you can see, this is some kind of addiction, isn't it? It takes over our mind. After the 9/11 attack on the U.S., when the towers fell, the advice that President George Bush gave us, the wise advice of the leader of the country, was to be angry and go shopping. Because shopping was good for the economy. And after this attack, we needed to make sure our economy stayed strong. You know? Oh. Maybe this is why I love Nagarjuna's book, The Precious Garland, the one, you know, that I was talking about the other night, Practical Ethics, Profound Emptiness. Nagarjuna gave explicit instructions to the king on how to govern the country so that it would be peaceful and the people would be well off. Yeah. And these are the exact kinds of things that Nagarjuna spoke about to the king. Yeah. So, you know, the American presidents need a special tutorial. Okay. What do you think is the biggest intoxicating thing nowadays? Handphones. Handphones and social media. What's the first thing you do in the morning? Check your messages. Yeah. Maybe something came for me. Have you ever gotten a message that has brought you infinite joy? No. Most of our messages are quite boring. But we still need to check all the time. Yeah, you're taking out your handphone right now. To check whether some new message came. Okay. At the Abbey, when people come for retreats, they have to turn in their handphones. Yeah. People look at us with horror, as if we are asking them to cut off posts.
part of their hand because the phone is permanently attached. So if you take the hand phone, you've got to cut my hand. How can I live without my hand phone? Actually, believe it or not, you can live without your hand phone. I am the only person of 7 billion who don't have a hand phone. Yeah, maybe there's a few other people like me. Yeah, do I look like I'm suffering intensely? Oh, people have hand phones and I don't. I don't know what my friend ate for breakfast. And that's the most important thing to check on social media. They tell me these important things about their life. And I missed out. Oh, thank goodness. I don't want to be available 24/7. Yeah? And I don't want to receive messages. I was teasing her. Because whenever we go places in Singapore, you know, we either get messages or we send messages about traveling there. So we were walking here, and she said, there's no messages asking where we are. And I said, that's because you're the one who's supposed to be sending the messages. We're walking down the stairs, my message. We're on the street now. We're walking down the street, another message. We're almost there. We'll be there in 1 minute. We're here. Yeah? That's what it's like. To tell you the truth, I don't want to receive those messages. I don't find them so interesting. Yeah? And I don't want to send messages like that. When somebody gets there, they get there. Okay, you know, in the case of an emergency, you're on the highway, yeah, you've had a flat tire, then they come in handy. Yeah. But aside from that, I don't know. Okay. And I actually think that a lot of social media is very detrimental. Yeah. First of all, a lot of it is fake news. So I agree with the president on one item. Except I think he's the source of most of the fake news. Okay, but I think, you know, there's a lot of fake news on social media. So you really have to use your discriminating wisdom. And I think it gives us distorted views of ourselves and of other people. Because when you set up your Facebook page, you set up everything good that's going for you in your life. Yeah. Look who I'm going out. Oops, I'm married. I'm not supposed to talk about that. You know, look what I ate for dinner. Look at this. Look at that. You create an image of yourself that you want other people to believe. You don't tell the ugly parts of yourself. Yeah. You don't reveal your mistakes on your Facebook account. Okay. So you create an image of yourself that is, I am a successful, wise, talented, rich, gorgeous, athletic person. So other people look at that, yeah. Or we look at other people's social media pages and we go, wow, their lives are going so well. But my life, you know, this is wrong and I have that problem. I just don't have the same opportunities. I don't have the same qualities. I'm not as good as that person. And we start comparing ourselves to that person, and then feeling awful about ourselves. Okay? And this is very deceptive because we're not comparing apples to apples, we're comparing apples to oranges. Okay? Because what somebody says on their social media account is an idealized version of themselves. And we're comparing that with what we know about our own lives. We don't know all that stuff about other people's lives. We don't know what's really going on in their minds. We know our own trials and tribulations. So we compare that with this idealized version of our friends. And that sets us up for a lot of feelings of being unworthy and being unsuccessful. And all of that is really false. Yeah? And very damaging to our self-confidence. Yeah? So remember last night when we were talking about joyous effort, we talked about the importance of having self-confidence. Yeah? Knowing we have the Buddha nature, going ahead, doing our best in our practice. Not getting waylaid by comparing ourselves to these false images of other people. Okay? So, you know, social media, hand phones, big intoxication, big addiction process. I heard in Korea, actually, they have rehab centers for young people who are addicted to social media and hand phones. Yeah? Okay, so my main point here was when you really look deeply in the precepts, you see all sorts of different aspects. And so that's what I was pointing out, talking about the precept of abandoning intoxication. A lot of different ways that manifests.